Okay. The whole week is the life of the mind in the movement of the state. So obviously their relationship between the schoolhouse and the state house. Abraham Lincoln said, "The philosophy in the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next." And I know I've told this story before, but I like this story, so I'm going to tell it again. There was the story of Fidel Castro when he first took over in Cuba in 1961. And one of the first things he did was to go into the schoolroom, kindergarten, and he had the children. Obviously, there's a very Roman Catholic presence there. And he said to the children, "Kids, bow your head, close your eyes, and ask God for candy." And they did. And he said, "Okay, open your eyes and pick your heads up." And they saw no candy there. And so he said, "Okay, now close your eyes and bow your heads again and ask Fidel for candy." And they did. And then he said, "Open your eyes." And they all had a piece of candy in front of them. And he said to them, "You see, kids, Fidel can give you what God cannot." And that is a picture not only of the totalitarian dictator understanding that you must eliminate God to have the state subsume everything under its power in society, but you also have to get the next generation. That's really the key, because today's kindergarten is tomorrow's electorate. And that's what those dictators understand, often in a way that Christians don't understand. In our day of rampant pietism in the churches, many Christians are apt to blow all that off and ask, "Well, what do we care about the state of the government in the next generation?" Well, one obvious, and there's a lot of answers you can give to that, but one obvious answer that we probably have neglected is that the same souls of the next generation who empower the tyrant are still the same souls who will hear the gospel in the next generation. And so one of the questions we might want to ask is, what does the philosophy which empowers the tyrant say about the gospel? What does it say about God? What does it say about everything else in the world? With such questions, and such questions should be obvious, we can see how pietism is very much an instrument of the tyrant's statism. For the Christian especially, the question of education has to begin with the question of content. So it's a theological question. But I made a point, it was sort of my big idea 2 months ago in the men's ministry teaching. I made the point that if the form and the content of our children's education does not teach that all truth is God's truth, then we contradict with our parenting what we say at church. And obviously that has to include God's truth about where history is going, God's truth about the state, how He ordained it, how it's just one more thing not to be worshipped. Those are the kind of truths that have to be taught from a Christian perspective, and it's not neutral. So here's where we're going today. First session, school and state, just the design, and throughout Western history, not just the biblical design, but what others have said about it and how that's gone down into American history. Second session, the Marxist revolution in the schools. And then thirdly, the counter-revolution of a Christian school. So that's where we're going today. And the first one is the school and the state. So hopefully you'll understand by that title that our question is a lot more specific than the design of education. This is not a class on education, this is a class on political science. We're asking the question, what is the relationship between the design of education and the design of the state? Or to say it another way, what is God's design for the relationship between these two institutions? So we're assuming not only that God has designed each of those institutions, we're also assuming that God has designed how those two designs relate to each other. That's just part of God's wisdom and providence, is designing the design between two designs. If God designed two designs, and many others in the world, then He also designed how they relate to each other. Because God's not a pluralist either when He creates the world. He designs things in His world to relate to each other in a very particular way. So here's the way we're going to look at the relationship between school and state. We're going to first look at the biblical view. We're going to look at the view that has been held throughout Western history, and I'm going to call that the glory and failure of the West. And then thirdly, the theological ungluing. And there I'm specifically going to look at in America. We could look at that in Germany. We could look at that in Rousseau. And I will mention Rousseau and his educational philosophy. But it's actually not as immediately effective in our civilization as guys like Horace Mann and John Dewey's philosophy has been. So we won't speak as much about Rousseau. But we're going to talk about the American devolution, I guess you could say, of theological education. But here's the big idea for this first session. The big idea is that God designed education that we would not be conformed to this world, but transformed by the renewal of our minds. So right from Romans 12:2, that's a good design, a good description of the design of education. And I could do a whole expositional thing just in that verse and show you how that applies to education. But that is God's design for education, that we would not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of our minds. So let's talk about that biblical view first. The first thing we need to do is we need to establish the fact that there is a biblical mandate, that such a mandate for education is in the Bible. Well, first of all, notice that there's a biblical mandate from God to parents and to the church to educate those under their care. And it really all starts in Deuteronomy 6, back in the home. I have here up on the board it flowing in this way. From God to parents through, and this is an open book, through books to their children. And that book can represent, I don't want to use the word expert, like an expert class that's detached from that, because that's the way we kind of define that. But servants toward that end. But parents are not abdicating that responsibility. They may be hiring servants, just like you do with books. You're not reinventing the wheel. But nevertheless, it's still the jurisdiction of the parents. So in Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 7, these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. And this is Moses, or ultimately it's God speaking through Moses to the parents of Israel. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. So clearly that kind of language is not speaking of a compartmentalized religious education, as if that's some kind of a thing on the side there, but a whole life and worldview. In fact, the Great Commission in the New Testament echoes this mandate in the form of disciples being made by, as Matthew 28:20 says, this is Jesus talking to the church, by teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Now, the moment you say, that's not education, that's evangelism. Well, read the whole thing. Jesus is apparently defining that evangelism as discipleship, as making disciples. And he further is defining that discipleship by teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. So you've got a dilemma if you want to reduce that to everything I've ever commanded you. I'm going to reduce this to everything God's ever said. That's a hard thing to reduce. But this shows us that the biblical design is two parents through a holistic process called discipleship. And that the church is very much involved in this. That parents are uniquely responsible means that they will be the ones ultimately relating the child to the curriculum, confronting the child with the curriculum. But it doesn't follow that there ought not to be specialists in the various academic disciplines. Teachers are then the servants of this education. Teachers are not an alternative to being over the curriculum and responsible for the children. But don't fly to the other extreme and make teachers dispensable any more than you do books. They're servants toward that end. So let's read and think carefully about these things to avoid superstitious ideas and action. The popularity of the homeschooling movement often communicates things as if the paternal responsibility is abdicated the moment anyone else is involved. And this is nothing other than superstition. The Bluedorns, for example, I have this really good book by Harvey and Lori Bluedorn called Teaching the Trivium. Great book. I think it can be just like Vodi Bachum's stuff. If you ask me, do you agree with Vodi Bachum? Yes, I do. I think he can be misread, though. And I don't want to speak for him either. I mean, he may be saying this to a certain extent. But if you read Deuteronomy 6 in such a way that the parents then have to reinvent every wheel, I think that's superstition. First, I don't think that's what Bodhibhaka means, and I don't think these guys mean either. But anyway, in this book, Teaching the Trivium, the Blue Dorns, whose approach seems to be more on the isolated end of the spectrum, nevertheless say this, quote, "Education is the father's jurisdiction, carried out by the father and the mother, and whomever they choose to employ for attaining specific goals." So that second part right there, you could, if you wanted to, read that to mean parents have the final say, and they can employ whoever they want, including the public school, the private school, homeschooling, books, seminars, whatever. You could do that, but that word whoever becomes pretty tricky at that point. Because then there's a lot of other things about the biblical worldview and education that might contradict. I certainly don't think that means whoever. I think the parents have a responsible choice to make, and there's a right choice and a wrong choice. Now, the truth is that most parents are not as well educated as so many leaders of the movement seem to be. And our children can easily turn into a homeschooling mascot as surely as those who advocate public school can make their kids into a missionary mascot. But there's no virtue in pretending to be somebody that you're not. Taking that mandate seriously from Deuteronomy 6 means applying the maximum force of excellence relative to your available resources. So think about that first rule of warfare from last week. The maximum force. Taking this mandate seriously means the maximum force of excellence in education with all the available resources, and those resources include other things that we're called by God to do. Things like work. We have to pay the bills. Raising other children who are not yet school-aged, some of them with various different learning abilities or disabilities. Keeping up with their hygiene. Eating. Sleeping. Okay? And so with all of that, we need help. Okay? And that's where the church, I think, comes in. Secondly, in the biblical view, we move from that imperative to the indicative. In other words, we move to see what the Bible says about the essence of education. The biblical view descends from its doctrines of truth, the soul, and the nature of soul transformation. So first of all, following from the link between parenting and teaching and discipleship, our children are persons with souls and minds. In other words, their equipment's going to work the same way ours does. And the modern form of education hates this. Oh, you're just making them little humans. They are. You're making them into little adults that absorb information. That's because that's what they are. Okay, Dewey hated that. But that's what they are. So, not only are they to be discipled, children are in one sense more of a disciple than most adults. They're a captive audience. Yes, they are sinners, but they don't have the freedom to act out in sin against the communication of knowledge that adults have. They will have excuses just as surely as adult sinners, but not the power to excuse themselves. So whether they're saved or not is not what I mean by they're actually more of a disciple than an adult at this point. In one sense, in the captivity of their being an audience, they are more of a disciple than an adult for 12 years. And that's significant. It's not everything, but it's significant. So notice that when we do get to the definition of classical education, or the classical definition of education later on, notice or remember that the Bible will already have said that the truth will make you free, John 8:32. When you see the link between education and freedom in the classical view, just understand that the Bible had already taught that. That the truth will make you free. Notice also that in the Bible we are commanded to, Romans 12:2, not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. That's a command. In Colossians 2:8, to see to it that nobody takes you captive through vain or hollow philosophy. That's a command. Who's it a command to? It's a command to everybody. These are commands from God to all Christians. So how can we say that this does not apply to our handling of our children's souls? How should we not only disobey this command for them, but teach them to disobey this command? The doctrine of the Spirit and the Word, or to say it another way, the biblical truth that the Holy Spirit is the efficient cause of our sanctification, and the truth of God's Word is the material cause of our sanctification, that shapes our educational expectations. We are told, for example, about the Spirit in John 16:13, that the Spirit will lead you into all truth. He just meant Sunday morning truth. He just meant Jesus truth. Relational truth. Religious truth. Inner truth. No, he said the Spirit will lead you into all truth. And that because of the Word, we can say, as the psalmist does in Psalm 119, I have more wisdom than all my teachers. Well, is that just more Sunday morning talk? Is that just religious truth? Well, thirdly, in the biblical view, there are texts which actually teach us the ramifications for the biblical view versus the non-biblical educational intake. For example, Luke chapter 6, 39-40, Jesus says, "Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit?" And listen to Jesus' words here. "A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher." There's a principle there. There's a law of the universe there. That you never rise beyond the level of your teacher in the main, in basics. What your input, what you put in, garbage out. If you send them to Caesar, they'll come back as Romans every time. And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. Fourthly and finally, we can see what a biblical education in all things says about God. The psalmist declares in Psalm 111:2, "Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them." Great are the works of the Lord, and studied by all who delight in them. What are the works of the Lord? Everything. Studied by all who delight in them. If you love God, you study all things theologically. Now consider that the greatest commandment tells us to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. All of our minds. So now how are we preparing our beloved children to relate to God in the greatest commandment if we present them with an education that explicitly detracts from theological unity and diversity? To take this question seriously is to despair over the very idea of falling short of a biblical model. Biblical truths like those beget more biblical questions. Questions like, well, what ideas do enslave us to nature and which ones liberate us? Are these two motions of the mind, transformation, in Romans 12:2 I'm talking about there, transformation from mere nature or conformity to mere nature, are these theologically neutral? Where do the objects of each of the academic disciplines stand in relation to this ultimate contest? Are they neutral? Is there a Christian way to teach math? I mean, come on! 2 + 2 = 4 to a pagan or to a Christian? Right? Well, we'll come back to that, but that's the biblical model. In Western civilization, there's what we also call the classical model that goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. So I'm going to call this section the glory and the failure of the West. So before I get to all those fun drawings, just to explain a little bit about what I mean here, what's called the classical model of education is no mere model, but an entire worldview. And therein lies its glory and its failure. It is explicit about being a view of the world, yet by biblical standards, its view is woefully incomplete. If you want to know what's wrong ultimately with a classical yet not biblical education, well, just read Augustine's City of God, and everything that he is criticizing the pagan world for, you can apply that to the pagan education. Okay? Now, the word education comes from the Latin verb to lead, ducare. That comes from that word right there. Ducare means to lead. So, educare came to mean to lead out of. So think of book 6 of Plato's Republic, book 7, where the slaves are chained against the wall, and Plato's philosopher leads them out of slavery, Because up till then, they were just looking at the shadows on the wall that the puppet masters were casting on the wall. And so Paul's imagery in Romans 1 is very, very similar to that language that Plato was using there. And the task of the philosopher was to point him to the eternal patterns and not to the shadows that were cast on the wall. Well, that is education. And not coincidentally, the adjective that was added to make it a liberal education comes from the Latin word for free, liber. So that to educate was to lead the soul to freedom from the tyrannies of mere nature. Not just the tyranny of the state, but if you ask Plato, he would have also said the tyranny of the body and material things, and that's Platonism. But at any rate, that is what the word came to mean. So education was viewed in the classical world as the primary factor in distinguishing between the free citizens and those who would be slaves. It was not only the mark of a free citizen, it was the means of a free citizen. When the universities in the Middle Ages had risen to the social distinction of the church and the state, you know, previously the state and the church were vying for power, well, between the 10th and the 14th century, the university had really risen to this kind of a, they called it a third ministry. They assumed for themselves a competing priesthood, complete with their own gowns, just as the priesthood of the church and the state had done. Academic freedom was hailed from the beginning to be just as valuable as judicial independence would be later on. And this reached its peak expression in the University of Paris, which by the turn of the 15th century had become a sort of theological dictatorship, even occasionally overruling Rome. So there you had this ministry of reason, and it eventually led to... Now, there's always been elitism, namely the focus of truth and value being in an expert class, a class of people that's by nature better than everybody else. And immediately in that definition, you lose the meaning of the word better because you have no standard of judgment beyond those. Same thing with the Roman Catholic view of truth or anything else. It's just one more form of relativism. It just reduces relativism. It starts out by saying, we can see. What can you see? Our diploma. Shut up. Okay, well then you're not seeing anything anymore. You're just asserting your bloodlines at that point. Okay? Well, a spirit of elitism had thus come to define the church, the state, and the university well before the Reformation. And since all three of these had a kind of ruling class, the philosophy of aristocracy was a natural fit for Europe's finest. Now, we briefly touched on aristocracy in week two or three, whatever it was. But it means... Here's that Greek word for rule, kratein. And that, the shorthand is the excellent, or the, so it's the rule of the excellent ones. So watch the real quick card trick here. It immediately goes from the rule of the excellent, which would be good, to the rule of the excellent ones, which you're no longer talking about excellence. You've immediately pulled one over on everybody. At first it seemed like you were talking about truth, until you start pointing at human beings, finite reference points. Okay? So at first it had the connotation of objective truth and immediately descends into bloodlines and whose mommy happened to have more money than somebody else's money. Somebody else's mommy. Well, money, same thing. Basically. Here's what happened in America. One thing that happened. The American founders erred at exactly this point in their conception of aristocracy. So they had a kind of a competing aristocracy, but they were just landowners. They were just hired hands, really, to the British. So you had a British aristocracy and you had an American aristocracy, and Washington and those guys wanted to be wealthy landowners and be their own kind of cultured class. And of course the British always looked down on them for that. And that created a lot of what was happening from the 1760s and onward. So the Americans really combined too much of their prideful feud with British elitism with the old classical sentiments expressed more recently in their time in a very unknown book to our time. A guy named James Harrington wrote a book called Oceana in 1656. And essentially, so this is like a classic document of justifying aristocracy. Essentially, it assumed that the more land you had, the less of a parasite your passions would be to others, which in turn would give a young man the space to cultivate natural virtue, of which the most excellent kind of virtue would become a republican virtue, or the virtue of a statesman who went to the capital only to make sure that enough other people stayed on their own land and minded their own business. But there's a lot of assumptions here about the natural course of nature. Now, this is not to say that the founders did not see an urgent need for widespread education, but it is to say that the problems associated with democracy, with the mob, burned much brighter in their consciousness. They were a lot more afraid of the mob and democracy than they were of elitism. So they come across as elitists if you read them and their concerns. They understood that most people, even after being exposed to civilizing culture, education, most people still tend toward the animal instincts, the base passions, and therefore are driven to tyranny. The mass of humanity simply cannot see what the aristocracy can see and must be brought into culture with great care. Now, every lie is a twisted truth. The very nature of shepherding in the scriptures assumes that the word overseer, episkopos, in the Bible, assumes that God grants to some the ability to see over what other people simply will never see in their lifetime. And that's why there's such a thing as legitimate leadership. But that immediately can become abused in the concept of aristocracy, as we saw. Well, what the founders had neglected was the even more obvious truth that population profusion, in other words, a massive growth in population, always outruns even the march of freedom. They did not adequately see that the cry of "give me liberty or give me death" should have been accompanied by the even more urgent cry to "give them education or they'll be happy to take you up on option B and kill you." Now, underneath all this political development in the 1760s, 80s, 90s, 70s, skipped a generation there. Underneath all that, there's a theological ungluing. So this is the third point of the first session. Underneath these secular movements of the American founding was the disillusion of the theology that made the whole thing possible to begin with. First of all, not every colony was informed by Puritanism. In fact, only New England was explicitly Puritan. So that, by that I mean Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rogue Island, as they're sometimes called, and parts of New York and, you know, the western or the eastern part of it. And New York being shaped by Geneva's other translators of the Reformation among the Dutch, Pennsylvania by Quakers and German Pietists, and then the more you go further south, the more you see the influence of Anglicanism, a later Anglican theology that was really trying to get away from Calvinism. Nevertheless, the Calvinistic idea was pretty much still dominant, and it was the Puritan strand from New England that drove the revolution. But it was a late Puritanism, and oftentimes it was a late Puritanism that was not at all settled on whether original Calvinism or whether Unitarianism was its defining theological idea. That may surprise you. Before the Great Awakening movements of the 1730s and 40s, Puritanism in New England was, from our perspective, at one with the Puritanism of England, except that it had struck out for a new world so as to extend its truth without compromise. Well, after the expelling and untimely death of Jonathan Edwards, a trend that was already begun by Arminian inroads in the generation before Edwards had flowered into full-fledged deism, universalism, or Unitarianism. Oftentimes it went hand in hand. Old Puritanism was supernatural and theological, so that piety and morality went hand in hand. By that I mean piety between man and God, vertical, morality horizontal, between man and man in God's covenant. Piety, Godward godliness, morality, manward godliness, were one cloth in the Puritan unified Christian worldview. Biblically revealed supernature provided that unity. Well, new Puritanism in New England was becoming natural and anthropological, man-centered, so that piety was set against morality, the private against the public, the higher against the lower, the doctrinal against the practical. All of this well underway, well before Immanuel Kant gave it an ultimate metaphysical superstructure in the generation after. How did this come to form the educational drive of this nation just as it was being founded? Well, one man in particular put a lot of ink to this project. His name was Horace Mann. Mann's dates are 1796 to 1859. And Horace Mann was a Unitarian churchgoer who, like all Unitarians at that time, positioned themselves against the Calvinists and as rightful heirs of the Puritan tradition of New England. So when you think of the Unitarians in, say, right about the year 1800, don't think of that lady Jude who was in the Truth Project. Remember her? The wizard. I think of God as a wind current coming from my hands right now. Don't think of that lady. That's where Unitarianism, that's where it goes. But at that time, Unitarianism was much more, I'm trying to compliment them, and I can't do it. They were much more serious. They were more serious than her. Okay, let's put it that way. I'm trying to be kind here. They were churchgoers, and from all accounts, they were outwardly pious. So all this stuff strikes us as odd today, but again, the Unitarians picked that part of America's Puritans that they felt moved them there, namely their libertarianism, not their Calvinism. Unitarians saw the Puritan tradition as the libertarian tradition, and we could do without their Calvinism. Well, naturally, the new Calvinism that they were reacting to by the turn of the 19th century lived up to the caricature and preferred piety to liberty. Preferred election to education. In other words, they agreed, they lived up to the caricature of divorcing the Godward life from the manward or the real life in history. They bought into that false dichotomy. So man began to conceive of, quote, common schools as the perfect antithesis to this one-way Christianity as held by the Calvinists. Much like Rousseau had done back in France, his educational theory was driven by his own flight from Calvinism. You know, Rousseau, I said I wasn't going to mention him, but Rousseau, French, generation before, same generation essentially as David Hume and Benjamin Franklin, the older of the founding fathers. And Rousseau wrote a series of books in the 1750s and 60s, but one of them that's lesser known than his political works is a book called Emile, which was his educational tract, and he's assuming that man is good. It's basically social Pelagianism, and you can see the same thing as political writings, that man starts good. Man is born free, but everywhere he's in chains. Well, what's the problem? The problem is a lack of education. And on this point, the Enlightenment deists are thinking pretty much, just on this one point, just like the old Greeks, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, the problem is education. There's a lack of education. Okay? So this is a flight from Calvinism. Man said this, quote, "If God is our father, all men must be our brethren," end quote. But speaking of parents, in fact, the parenthood of the state had already begun to replace the concept of the motherhood of the church in his thinking. Like the earliest pilgrims of New England, universal public school was viewed as a good. Yet, unlike those old Puritans, man saw this as an end in itself, because of the inherent good of human beings. Public education, man thought, was God's will, and thus it was the child's right, and thus it was the government's responsibility. In fact, it was actually because it was the child's right that it was God's will. You see that? So the vertical, the theological, is shaped by the rights of man. The rights of man, not Tom, or Horace Mann, the lowercase of man. As a matter of fact, the theological metamorphosis, particular of American religion, and here I have a little chart in your notes. You'll see it if you printed out the notes. And I put it in your notes because I didn't have it up here, but I can draw it. But there's a theological metamorphosis going on as a whole, particularly in American religion, between the era of the two awakenings. In other words, between 1730 and 1830, roughly. They're experiencing an overall shift that horizontalized the meaning of what was educational and the meaning of what was evangelical. And a discerning student of history will be able to see the symmetry of these two shifts. So I'll put it in that little space over there. No, sorry, I will actually erase this since I already did this. Give me a slightly bigger place to put it on. So I'm going to draw two arrows facing upward, signifying our definition of the form of something. In this case, the gospel, in this case, truth. You're going to see a synergy between how we conceive of theology as a whole and how we conceive of education. The meaning of a Greek word and a Latin word, not that there's anything special about where they came from, but just the original meaning of these words, euangelion, meaning gospel, and educare, meaning education, goes in this direction. Because the overall theological shift is a horizontalizing, flattening. In other words, the concern is not who God is and what God's doing, but the concern is who man is and what man can do. That theology between 1740 and 1840 shifts the meaning of these things from the things to the spreading of these things. So the word evangelical moves in its meaning from the gospel, in other words, news content about how God has saved sinners, to the spreading of the gospel. And if I was to ask you, what are you spreading there? And you said, spreading. I would clearly recognize that you have lost a few marbles or that you had misheard me or something. And the same thing with education. If I ask you, what is education? And you say, no child left behind. I'm going to wonder if you've misunderstood the question, if you've misheard me, or something to that effect. But that happens as a result of the overall theology shifting from God to man with the loss of the Puritan concept. Well, regardless then of the ecumenical intentions of the Unitarians, man pushed both for the secular shift in the curriculum, its ends, its means, and for the state control of it in order to ensure its universality. You say, how? Wait a minute. Surely this man is self-deceived. Yes, he is, but not in the most explicit way that you might be thinking. In 1800, it was possible to think you were a Christian in a supernatural way. In other words, to not have any of the problems that liberal theologians would have in just a generation after you. You believe the Bible is God's Word. You believe that God exists. You believe that Jesus came to save sinners, and so on, and so on, and so on. But everything you see in the Bible is a mirror for your own performance, particularly a social performance. And of course, we're not experiencing another wave of that today, are we? Okay? It's a common mistake. Okay? So these were not explicit naturalists. They were implicit naturalists, which is how naturalism creeps up. It doesn't show up at your door with a pitchfork and a horns and hoofs and say, how you doing? I'm Charles Darwin. I'm here to take your kids. Sure. Why not? That's not the way it works. It gets ripped through the IV in church and sermon Sunday after Sunday. All right? So it's an implicit naturalism going on here. Okay. Well, what was to be accomplished? Why was man doing this? What was the end goal? Well, a better society. For one thing, a fact-filled man, an educated man, will commit fewer crimes. Why? Because if man's nature is good, and the trouble is his lack of education, well then the presence of education will give his goodness a real outlet. But what have we seen? We've seen the exact opposite. We've seen that with the presence of government schools, not since the 1960s, but even since the 1850s, a corresponding explosion of antisocial thought and behavior with the secularization of the curriculum. Man saw this public education as the savior and even used salvation kingdom language to define it. He said in one book, quote, the question for us is, has not the fullness of time now come? About education. And elsewhere in another book, he says, quote, intelligence, like the blood sprinkled upon the doorposts of the Hebrew houses, will prevent the destroying angel of despotism from entering. Well, it's interesting imagery and parallelism there, but he's clearly not just using a metaphor, but is in fact substituting the social good, as all of God's children can clearly see it all together at the same time, the social good as the very definition of the kingdom. So, with that, I will end the first session, and that's how it all went down, at least on American soil, and then it really goes downhill in the 19th century.